Warm Regards, Conversations from the Front Lines of Climate Change. I'm Ramesh Longani, an Associate Professor of Biology at Doane University. In today's episode, we'll chat about the recent report from the IPBES, that's the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, talk with Reverend Susan Hendershot and Brian Souter from Interfaith Power and Light about how they motivate action on climate change by speaking to people about their faith, and we discuss why we need to take a cue from Scooby-Doo and listen to our meddling kids on climate change and how effective it can be in changing minds around the topic. Also, today's episode will be the last one before a short summer hiatus. We'll be back in late summer with new episodes, so please keep an eye out for those or subscribe so you can pick up listening to our new episodes as soon as we're back. My co-host this week is Dr. Sarah Myrie, senior fellow at Project Drawdown and founder and executive director at the Rowan Institute. How's life in the Pacific Northwest, Sarah?
Ramesh, it's really good. It's great to talk to you today, and I'm excited for all the content we're going to cover as well.
What's been going on there?
Well, I actually went down to California last weekend and went to Lightning in a Bottle, which is a electronic music festival where I gave a talk about climate change and Project Drawdown solutions. And let's see what happened. There was a trailer fire at 6:30 in the morning. The place was flooded. The music was amazing. I was filthy. I met amazing people that are doing such beautiful work in the world. So it was like adventure capital A for
wow.
This. Yeah, for this 36-year-old mom of a 5-year-old. So the adventure continues in giving science talks around the West Coast.
Yeah, that's quite sort of your non-standard venue for talking about climate change.
Yeah, non-standard is like a gentle way of putting it. But honestly, like the opportunity to talk to people in this kind of vulnerable and connected space about our planet and the planet's relationship to the rest of the solar system and the history of our planet, just how beautifully connected life on the planet is to Earth history. I think that was just this kind of incredible crystallization of opportunity for connecting with people about these ideas.
Yeah.
So check and check. It was great.
Yeah. You know, and thinking about the interconnectedness of life, I wanted to spend a couple of minutes discussing this recent report from the IPBES that came out about this sort of global state of biodiversity. It's gotten a fair bit of press, specifically the part about 1 million species being under threat from human activity, and one of those threats being climate change. What was your impression of the report so far, or what you've read about it?
Well, I would say to start, like my cynical and hard piece inside of me that's been exposed to the science of extinction and what we are doing to the planet right now, I wasn't surprised. And I didn't have the grief response that I know many other scientists and environmental advocates had at the time. I think I was just exhausted from other things. So I had kind of an empathy fatigue response where I really didn't have the emotional response to it. But the sort of quantitative and scientific assessment, it is in alignment with what we, I think, have known for a long time that we're doing to the planet. I mean, we're changing the entire surface of the planet, every single land surface and every square inch of the global ocean. And we're changing not only the biological and physical and chemical and ecological identity of these locations, but we're doing it really fast. And at the same time, we're removing so much biomass. We're cutting down trees, we're eating animals, we're causing so much change. So I think reports like this kind of help sober people up and help them align with the reality of living on a living planet, a planet that has been dramatically reshaped from human influence. But it is jarring, and I'm there with a big, open, broken heart for those of you that are trying to process the information.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, when I saw that million species number, I didn't quite know how to process it because it sounds like a big number. And then, you know, my scientist brain was started thinking, well, a million out of how many, and how is the public, you know, is that too big of a number for an average citizen to digest or turn into action? And
right.
I also thought a piece that was sort of underreported is the idea about ecosystem function and ecosystem services. I think that oftentimes gets not enough press, the idea that we as a species are highly dependent on the services that our planet provides. And so a million species is a nice headline, but the services that are under threat, I think, are much more impactful and are going to have a much larger impact on whether or not we can grow crops in a particular place or the productivity levels and all of those things. And I feel like that's unfortunately been underreported. The million species number came out and that was the big shining red orb.
Right. My colleague, Catherine Wilkinson, was talking on Twitter earlier this week about some of her responses to it, where, you know, we have this dichotomy, this narrative where we're conserving the world for life on this planet for the elephants and for the whales, or we're conserving the planet for human life and for people. And that narrative is a myth of separation, and it's a dangerous one. Because ultimately, a planet that doesn't serve polar bears is not a planet that can serve and meet our needs as well. I think we focus on, like I just did, like charismatic megafauna, right? We talk about the animals. But what we don't really remember from a systems thinking is that all the movement of carbon and nutrients and oxygen and energy and heat around this planet, we are enmeshed in that system. We like a very small liminal window as human beings. We tolerate a very small window. And we are connected to all of the rest of the life on this planet. It's not West Coast woo-woo, right? It's actually basic science about how, where our food is produced, how we heat our homes, where our water comes from, how we get around the planet, where our culture comes from, everything.
Yeah. So I know with my students, I've tried to, a couple of them have asked me questions about that million number. I've gotten a couple of emails from them. I'm just sort of confused, you know, and I've been struggling trying to put that in perspective. The report popped out sort of right at the end of the academic year. So right as my students were sort of studying for finals and getting ready for graduation, this super large kind of depressing report came out, you know, and so they were trying to struggle with that while studying for a final exam. And so that's been an interesting dialogue to have with my students, because I've been saying, hey, right now, let's focus on finals and, you know, put out the fires that are most immediate, and then we can talk about those things. And so, like I said, it's been an interesting conversation, especially with my students. So speaking of students, as I mentioned, it's the end of the year. It's graduation season. And recently, after a graduation ceremony, I was invited to a graduation dinner of one of my research students. And at that dinner, I had a conversation with my student's father about climate change. Now, I knew the student's father was on the conservative end of the political spectrum. And so when he asked me to chat about climate change over dinner, I must admit I was a little hesitant. I was a little worried. He started the conversation by asking me, well, hasn't the climate always changed? How do we know it's us? So immediately I was like, cool, we're going to do this over dinner. Awesome. And, yeah. So I sort of gathered myself and I laid out some of what I thought to be some of the most compelling pieces of evidence. And he was open to those facts. And really throughout the remainder of the conversation, we moved more towards policies that address climate change and away from causality. And it became clear that his, you know, quote unquote objections to climate change, for lack of a better term, was really had less to do with his acceptance of the science and had more to do with a difference in opinion about the role of government in addressing big challenges. And that really got me thinking as I reflected on that conversation, because it was a great example of what Catherine Hayhoe, a well-known climate scientist, advocates for in terms of just having conversations about climate change. It also really got me thinking, because I had a strong relationship with his daughter, my student, there was sort of an inherent level of trust there, and we're able to have a civil conversation about this topic that didn't end in a yelling match or a flipping of tables. We ate dinner, we were all fine, we hugged at the end of the meal, and was really great is we were able to have a conversation that didn't conflate the science and the policy. And the other thing about this is that this conversation reaffirmed for me the importance of speaking to a person's values when talking about climate change. Now, did this conversation with me make him a staunch supporter of the Green New Deal? No, but it did, I hope at least, move the needle a bit on the science around climate change. And he did ask for my contact information, so I'm sure we'll be continuing the conversation. So I'll take that as a win. And I bring up this conversation, especially with the guests we have today. So today's guests are Reverend Susan Hendershot and Reverend Brian Souder from Interfaith Power and Light. And they know all about how to move the needle on climate change by speaking to people's values. Reverend Hendershot, Reverend Souder, welcome and warm regards. We're so excited to have you on the show today. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So why don't we start? I'm not sure how many of our listeners are familiar with Interfaith Power and Light. We'll call it IPL just for short, if that's okay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about IPL and what its mission is and how it effectively speaks to people's values to motivate action on climate change?
Sure. I'd be happy to jump in there. So Interfaith Power and Light, our mission is to inspire and mobilize people of faith and conscience to take bold and just action on climate change. We started in the year 2000 in California. It was originally California Interfaith Power and Light and grew sort of organically over the years to include state affiliates now in 40 states around the country. And so my colleague Brian runs our affiliate in Illinois and is doing amazing work on the ground there. And we have great affiliate leaders all over the country. One of the things that is really cool about the work that we do is we do sort of a both and, right? We run programs that are very practical, teach people about how to measure their energy use, for example, or how food systems contribute to climate change and what they can do to reduce their consumption. And so there are some very practical hands-on programs, but what those programs allow us to do is to help people understand the issue of climate change, how their behaviors contribute or actually help with solutions. And then we move them through to become advocates. So they are advocating through the state affiliates at the local, the state, and then also through the national office at the national level on climate and energy policies. So it's a really exciting way to connect with people through their faith communities in ways that allow them to be part of the solution.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, just to lift up, you know, doing this work in Illinois, what's clear to us is that the messenger matters, which I think was similar to the comments with your family or with friends and colleagues. Some polling data just came out here in the Midwest that's fascinating with Trump voters on climate change. Those voters are much more likely to listen to climate scientists who are at Big Ten universities located here in the Midwest. And similar to what we do with the faith community is the best messengers to the faith community are people of faith who understand that culture, the history, the theology, even the politics of the local faith institutions and can really meet people where they're at. That's where IPL does such great work in that we have these programs where people can get in where they fit in, start to learn about this, build trust, build relationships, and then really become long-term advocates for change and continue to grow the environmental presence and movement in our advocacy work across the nation.
And to be clear, so Brian, you're in Illinois and Susan, you're out in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Yes.
Give our listeners a sense of geography.
That's correct.
Okay. So are both of you part of IPL or are you part of different chapters? I'm using all the wrong vocabulary here, but I'm just trying to give our listeners a sense of how the structure works.
Yeah. So the national office is based in San Francisco. We also have a staff position located in Washington, D.C. that helps coordinate our federal policy work there. Then we have state affiliates that are located in 40 states around the country. And so one of those affiliates is Illinois, where Brian is serving as their executive director.
Okay.
Well, I have a question for both Brian and Susan, and I just wanted to kind of get the conversation down to the ground around values, because we want to get to some shared spaces here and how we can build a language and a conversation. Because as humans, like our values, I have very strongly rooted values, but they don't necessarily come from a place of structured faith. They come from other places in my life. I suppose my question is, how do you find communities of faith? How do you connect with them? Where do they find value in addressing climate change? How do you meet them?
I'm going to let Brian start on this one.
All right. Yeah. So there's a number of values that guide the work, I think. And it's always what's interesting about the conversation is what I have found here in Illinois is it begins by doing a shared program, like just of saying, hey, we all have common land, common air. We breathe, you know, the same air. We drink the same water. Let's work on a project together. And then what beautifully unfolds is as, you know, because we work with multiple faith institutions, so we could be working with a mosque or a parish or a temple or a synagogue. So we bring people together from different faith backgrounds who might suspect that they have different values at first, but then we start to work on a project together. Maybe we're, you know, all getting on a bus early in the morning to head down to our state capital to do an advocacy day. And that's when people start to share their values, like why they care about climate change and taking action on climate change. And the most beautiful thing happens, despite the religious and racial and geographic diversity, people have really shared values around taking care of current generations, future generations, feeling that they have a strong moral calling to live on behalf of the next generation coming forward. And that seems to be a commonality that's lifted up, along with, you know, the value of truth. What does science have to tell us about the impacts that we're having? And this is where the messenger matters, really, to be able to sort out in this sort of political climate what is truth, what isn't truth. That relationship is also a value that you want someone you can trust and have a long-term relationship with, and that has credibility and speaks the talk, is really important for that going forward. So that is the beautiful thing. Like, we work with such a diversity of people, and yet we do come around these shared values of what we share in common, speaking truth and taking action on behalf of future generations.
Yeah. And I'm just going to add on to that if I can, because that was so well said, Brian. And for me, as I think about values and how what we value becomes a part of this conversation, you know, so many times when we talk to people who are involved in this work, regardless of their background, they will talk about that they come to this work because they care about their children or their grandchildren and the world that they're going to inherit. And of course, we know that climate change doesn't just impact future generations, it impacts our own, you know, right here in the here and now. And so as we think further about values, really centered in this work for us is justice. You know, we want to work with inclusion and respect. We value courage, you know, the courage of speaking with a prophetic voice in the case of the faith community. I think ultimately for us, this work is about love. It's, you know, it's about love for our neighbors. It's about love for the earth and all of its inhabitants. And it's about our connection to the sacred, which, you know, we call by different names, but God or the sacred or Allah or, you know, whatever word we may use there. And so when you spoke a while ago, Sarah, about this myth of separation, I sort of, you know, latched onto that in my mind, because it is so prevalent, this idea that we are separated from one another, or we're separated from the earth, or we're separated from God or the sacred. And instead, you know, moving us to this place of interconnection and interdependence that we know is the reality of how the earth works and how we are supported by the earth.
Yeah, the myth of separation, like, it's everywhere. And we have to push away from these narratives that we don't mean anything to each other, and that the world is a terrible place. When listening to you too, there are so many commonalities with the fundamental roots of the work that I do. And I think love for the world and love for each other is the through line of all of this, is trying to show up and care for each other. It's not that hard to find our commonalities, but we actually have to, like, come forward with that raw and wounded heart that is seeing the brokenness in the world and say, you know, I'm no longer willing to sit on the sidelines. And I'm not that cool girl who is never earnest and never transparent about her feelings in public. It takes that vulnerability of coming forward. Thank you for doing that work so much.
And so you both mentioned this idea of motivating your congregations or these events around care for future generations and sort of interconnectedness. Do you feel like that is the most effective messaging? Is the wrong word, but do you feel like that's the most effective messaging? Or do you think the idea of being good stewards of the earth or taking care of the less fortunate, because you brought up justice, which is obviously deeply tied to climate change issues, which message do you think motivates the most action amongst the faith communities, you know, either across faiths, or am I oversimplifying it by saying there's a single message that, you know, motivates the most action?
Well, I'll tell you, I want to tell you a quick story that relates to this. A few years back, working on some legislation campaigns, that was anti-fracking legislation here in Illinois, and the high volume hydraulic fracturing was taking place in rural southern Illinois. And I had the job that day to speak to a church on the south side of Chicago, an African-American church, about joining our cause to prevent this activity that was going to happen way down south. And I felt like going into it, I had an impossible task, because here I was talking to an audience from an environmental justice community, a community that suffers disproportionately from air pollution in their own backyard, from toxic dumping and waste. And I thought, here I am telling them about an injustice that's happening deep down in southern Illinois that really doesn't impact them, but we need their legislators to get on board to help us pass these further restrictions. And what I learned in that church basement was that morning was, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois once told Booker T. Washington in the course of a dialogue that your life is my life and my life is your life. And we can't ever forget that. And the audience was immediately ready to go do the advocacy on behalf of their brothers and sisters down in Southern Illinois, because they were saying, we're going to need our brothers and sisters to have our back to fight our own injustices.
Yeah.
And that sort of interconnectedness has always stuck with me, of that your life is my life and my life is your life. And together, things that impact you also impact me. I've just seen that. It's almost like we're talking and highlighting this value of connectivity, which I think, Sarah, you were saying earlier that, you know, often with the work we do in Illinois is often people first. We highlight the justice issues that impact our children, the asthma rates, the basement flooding in communities, the lack of access to open space and to food. But when we address our solutions through that environmental justice lens, then, you know, we create a world where the whales are taken care of, the polar bears are taken care of as well, and it's all connected. That's the experience I've had, and it's always been one of the most hopeful things I've experienced when people stand up on behalf of one another, recognizing that interconnectivity between all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about justice, not just us. And so many of us, and you see this really clearly with the leadership of white women that are trying to come forward in feminist spaces. And this is sort of a criticism of my own community, obviously. If you show up in public with an agenda and a desire for justice, but that desire for justice doesn't cross the threshold of your front door, then what you really want is just you. You want your people, the people that look like you, you want your issues addressed. And so you haven't done the work that's necessary to see the interconnections of justice. And that, just exactly like you said, if your food and your body is bombarded by environmental toxins and pollution, and your quality of life, there's no way that I'm not connected to that. Like, you're breathing the same air, we're drinking the same waters. We have to see each other's wounding as equal and as worthy of justice and attention and care. That's one of the things that I have learned as I've tried to come forward and realizing, like, oh, okay, there's my glaring omission right there. There's something that a lens that I didn't have well refined.
So Susan, in your experience, has there been a particular message type that has resonated more or less successfully?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about in particular is how we meet people where they are. And, you know, you sort of alluded to this with the story about, you know, you're sitting with your student's father and having that conversation. That was very much meeting him where he is. And my own story, my own background, I served local congregations for many years as a pastor. You know, the issue that I was most focused on at the time was the issue of hunger. And, you know, climate change, I knew that was an issue and some people were working on it, but I thought, well, you know, I'm recycling and I changed my light bulbs and, you know, I've done my thing. So, what happened for me was reading an article that connected the dots for me between the destruction of crops due to drought and wildfire that were fueled by climate change and sort of resulting food shortages, and having this aha moment where I thought, if I really want to address the issue of hunger, I need to shift my focus and work on climate change. And I tell that story a lot when I speak to groups, because I think that it resonates with some people in the audience who can say, well, you know, my congregation is working on hunger, or we're working on the issue of immigration, or we're working on disaster relief issues. You know, so many of these issues that people of faith have been working on for as long as any of us can remember. Sure. They don't think about the fact that climate change, you know, is further exacerbating those issues and is actually a threat multiplier, as the military says. And so trying to help people connect those dots and see where their place is and how attending to the issue of climate change can help address this other issue that they're really passionate about. And I think the thing to note about that is that it really takes us not just talking, but listening in order to get to that place where we understand and can have that conversation.
Yeah. And as you were describing that, what struck me, you know, you read this article that connected the dots for you. And I'm curious to know, in both your experiences, how have you struck that balance between, I'm going to make a false dichotomy here, but so I apologize in advance. How have you struck that balance between the facts that we know about climate change and speaking to somebody's heart, you know, those less tangible things, right? So how have you balanced that in your messaging?
I'm going to dive in. Sorry, Brian, because I love that question, because I think when I started this work, I thought, well, if I just say the facts the right way enough times that you know, people will jump on board and magically, you know, start taking action. And that, in my experience, doesn't work. But I think one of the things that's really important to our work is storytelling and being able to tell our own stories and help connect to people's hearts through stories rather than through more charts and graphs. So that was what I wanted to say. Brian, you probably have more to add to that.
Well, I just want to build on what Susan, you're saying too, because the listening piece is essential. In Illinois, we did a listen, lead, share campaign where all across the state of Illinois, you know, different areas with different groups, we helped shape together legislation to introduce in our General Assembly around addressing the issue of climate change. And one thing that came out of those listening sessions was a real desire for folks who are coming out of prison, or people who are going through the foster care system and at high risk for going into prison. Those communities saying, look, we want to find jobs for people who are coming either out of prison or at high risk for going into prison, because we know a good paying job can make all the difference.
Right.
And that actually led to just yesterday in Illinois, we launched a program called Solar for All, which is tens of millions of dollars that's training up foster care youth and alumni and returning citizens for solar jobs. And they're actively getting hired right now. And the solar developers are getting extra incentives in this program and extra renewable energy credits for hiring from those programs. And so by listening, we start to learn how to better connect the dots, right? And pretty soon we're connecting the dots between social justice and environmental justice and learning that they're the same things, and that mass incarceration is tied to a just economy, which is tied to environmental justice. And it just becomes like, with the grief and lament and the news that we're getting, you know, it becomes a very hopeful thing to work on that level where you are connecting the dots and making real impact in people's lives and changing neighborhoods and communities for the better as we grow the green economy in order to address climate change in a holistic fashion.
Yeah.
Brian and Susan, I have maybe a self-motivated question, but you know, I've been swimming in the community of environmental scientists, climate scientists, ocean scientists for about 15 years now. And I see the cost of the work that they do, because I want to ask about pastoral care and like what people need in order to do this work. So short story is, I went to a workshop in Italy when I was a graduate student, and I was there listening to paleoclimate scientists and climate modelers. And one of the scientists, very prominent carbon modeler, one of the most famous scientists really in the world. And he was talking about hyperthermals, so these past events of carbon system disruption and the temperature changes that went with them, and just remarkably scary scenarios of global change. And so I remember asking him like, hey, yo, this information is really important and super valuable for the public to know. How do you talk to people about the work that you do? And this guy responded by saying, I'm done with that. F those people. In
wow.
This like very hard, yeah, really angry, like immediately angry, immediately wounded. And I was traumatized by that moment, because I realized like, oh no, these are not the heroes that we were waiting for. Like, this is not what I was looking for in terms of leadership. Empiricists, knowledge workers, engineers, scientists, mathematicians, they may lack some of the emotional intelligence that's necessary to come to the table for pastoral care, for the needs that are met in community. I wonder if you could speak to this, if you've seen anything like this, and how would you care for those knowledge workers?
Wow. Yeah, that's a powerful story. And, you know, it reminds me, several years ago, I read, it's kind of an overview of a study that was conducted, very small study, I think, with people who work in the environmental field. And basically what it showed is that many people who work in the environmental field suffer the same symptoms as those with post-traumatic stress disorder. And for some of us, that's not terribly surprising to hear that.
Sure.
But also that those who were in supportive relationships, whether it was, you know, friends or colleagues or family or some other supportive community, that the incidence was much lower for them. So to me, I think about the work that we do with Interfaith Power and Light, and also the work, for example, that's going on the ground in places like Illinois. One thing that we're trying to do, right, is create supportive community, because not only do we have a larger voice when we're working together in terms of moving policy, but we also know that we're in this together,
right.
And that, you know, that part of the outcome that we want is for people not to feel like they're alone, that they're the only person who cares about this or is trying to work on it. And I also think that the point is well taken, right? That this is hard work. There's a lot of grief. We see all these reports, you know, coming out every day, like the one you were alluding to earlier in the program. We just keep getting hit by all this bad news. And it does take an emotional, a spiritual, and even a physical toll, depending upon, you know, if you're the person suffering from a climate disaster yourself. And part, I think, of our role is to provide active hope. So not hope that says, oh gosh, I hope everything works out, right? That's really passive hope.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of hope we're talking about. But we're talking about the kind of hope that says, we actually can influence the outcome of this. The future is not already determined, despite what all of the reports are pointing us to. And there still is opportunities for us to change that outcome and make a better outcome. So it's that kind of active hope that we're really focused on.
As we were talking about active hope, that got me thinking about, how do you get people to believe in that active hope? So it's sort of getting at, like, what are the challenges that IPL faces when trying to move people on climate through either active hope or through the lens of faith? Like, what are some of the challenges that you've dealt with? You know, what are the walls that you keep sort of running into? You're like, oh, we just can't get around this.
Well, I'm enjoying listening to Susan. I think what Susan said on the pastoral care is just spot on. And I think a challenge we face generally, I know I face this in my own leadership, is as people of faith, we have thousands of years of history of spiritual wisdom that we can glean from on this wisdom around grief and suffering and lament, wisdom around, you know, this deep desire that we all have to belong in community and to encounter someone else in this work. And the desire to work and do something meaningful with our life. You know, our religious traditions are rich with these sort of things and ways to, you know, we call it emotional intelligence today,
right,
but to express our anger towards doing that work together and express the deep hurt and sadness that we have in belonging with community and knowing and believing actively that the legacy of our suffering and the pain is indeed love, and to orient towards that. So there's moments I find, you know, when I'm not being nourished in this work, I guess, that I'm forgetting to pull deep from that well of spiritual wisdom and pastoral care that's right there available to me. It might be a surprise to know that even someone with reverend in front of their title needs pastoral care, right? Doing this work and staring at it is a very, you know, every day takes a lot of courage. And in order to grasp that courage, we have all sorts of resources and tools at our fingertips. But it takes, you know, speaking up and having the bravery to say, this is really hard, and to create space where grief is acceptable and that grief can lead to much more beautiful outcomes.
Yeah, and I would just, you know, I want to add on to that. I was thinking about, you know, this role for faith leaders using their prophetic voice. And, you know, I think about the prophets in the Judeo-Christian tradition. You know, sometimes we think of prophets as like people who predict the future, right? But I always think of the prophets as human beings who faced the reality of the time that they were living in, right? They looked at the actual sort of political, social environments that they were living in, and calling people to account, but saying it doesn't have to be this way, that actually there is a hopeful future for us. And this is how that, you know, they paint the picture of what the hopeful future can be, but they call people to transformation. They say, in order for us to reach that hopeful future, we have to change. And here's what that change needs to look like. And I feel like that is such a role for faith leaders right now, to call us to that transformation that needs to happen. A spiritual transformation, I think, is sort of ultimately at the heart of what needs to happen in order for us to really solve this crisis that we're in.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for saying that. I think that really, knowing that you two are also experiencing the need for pastoral care, and that you draw upon rich history and the context of the movements towards justice, that you sit in community with each other to try and repair historical wounds and to draw that wisdom forward to kind of manifest a new kind of way of being in the world. Climate change really changes everything because we have to start accounting for all of this externalization of harm that the systems that we rely on produce. And we have been ignorant of those systems. Now, as that dawning awareness is changing, it's really changing who we are on this planet and what it means to be, I think, moral and ethical. And so thank you for talking about all those like different toolkits and pieces and community. And as we transition now, my question is around the discrete pieces of legislation and effort that your community is focused and working on. Would you mind sharing briefly some of these discrete pieces so that our listeners could find those pieces and maybe be attracted to ways they could be involved in the future?
Yeah, I'll jump in right away on that.
Yeah, Sarah,
I also just want to add, you know, notice the world we're talking about and the solutions are really at the root cause. Like, yeah, we do the PowerPoints about climate science, you know, in the church basements to talk about the realities we're facing, but the real transformational mm-hmm. work to address the root causes of our environmental injustices is much deeper. And as, you know, Susan was talking about, the learning and growing towards transformation is why groups like Interfaith Power and Light are so important, because they help us remember that deep tradition and history and to take advantage of that for such a moment as this. And then that leads into our advocacy work. So in Illinois, our big push right now is something known as the Clean Energy Jobs Act that came out of our listen, lead, and share sessions that I shared about, where communities came together and said, hey, we want 100% renewable energy by 2050 in Illinois, but we want to put equity first and make sure those jobs come back to the communities that suffer most from air pollution and the impacts of climate change and basement flooding and access to open space and local food. And it also does a lot of work around making our public transit infrastructure more electric, taking diesel off the roads and reducing climate change through electric vehicles, also with an equity focus, as well as decarbonizing our infrastructure in Illinois. So that's a really excited effort. We like to say it's the real deal in Illinois. It's like the new Green Deal, but it's actually made real in legislation in Illinois. And just Thursday, we had an advocacy day where over 500 faithful advocates traveled down to our state house capitol to let our legislators know that we want to see them make that bill a law and pass the Clean Energy Jobs Act.
That's great. That's great. Susan, are there pieces of legislation that you're currently involved in?
Yeah, well, and adding on to what Brian said, I would say for the listeners who are in various states around the country, we have a map on our website that shows where all our state affiliates are at interfaithpowerandlight.org. So you can check to see what's happening in your state, because our state affiliates are very engaged in state and local level policy. So we want to give them a shout out here. But also to say, at the national level, we've been really focused for quite a while now, the last couple of years, on protecting the EPA safeguards on a number of things. For example, the fuel efficiency standards, methane standards, as well as mercury standards. So we've been really focused on protecting those EPA safeguards. Additionally, we just had our fly-in with state leaders into Washington, D.C., where we went to the Hill and talked to our members of Congress about, on the House side, about H.R. 9, which is about keeping the U.S. in the Paris Climate Accord. Happy to say that that did pass out of the House, and so we're waiting to see what will happen on the Senate side with that. And then another, I think, great piece of legislation that we've been involved in is called the Reclaim Act. And that is about coal mining communities, places where there are abandoned coal mines, about 20,000 of them around the country, looking at an effort to clean up those abandoned coal mines and provide a just transition for workers into new jobs in those communities. So we think it's bipartisan. It's in both the House and the Senate. And we're really excited to see that move forward as a bipartisan piece of legislation. So just a couple of examples.
Great, you know, and I think that's actually a great place to sort of end today's conversation and move to our unexpected science piece as we think about tangible things that everyone can get behind in terms of advocacy. I just want to express my thanks having both of you on the show. You know, I grew up in a Hindu household, so I didn't grow up going to church, but I felt like I was at church. It was great. I feel very inspired. Yeah. So thank you for all your great work across faiths and working with legislatures. So I'll start to take a hard left turn as we move to our unexpected science piece. This week's unexpected science piece talks about the role of kids and their ability to move the needle on climate change. I think Sarah is going to tell us about that work that recently came out.
Yes, I am. And I agree, Brian and Susan, thank you for your time and your leadership in this space. So the Unexpected Science is about a paper that came out on the 6th of May this month. The paper is titled Children Can Foster Climate Change Concern Among Their Parents. This was published in Nature Climate Change. And so, I mean, this dovetails into the rich space that we've been talking about today, because the generation of children that are coming up is a generation that's being told again and again and again that their future is foreclosed upon, that the world that they love is coming to an end. And so I think it fits really importantly and richly in this conversation. We obviously are seeing the onslaught of international leadership, specifically from young girls around the world with the Friday climate strikes, the school strikes. The culture is changing around us. And what these researchers wanted to understand is, can children change their parents' minds about climate outcomes? What they found is that actually, yeah, children are incredibly effective messengers for changing their parents' level of concern, because children are coming from essentially an unpolitical and unpartisan place. They're coming from a morally grounded place. I think kids, I mean, I have a five-year-old. The clarity of my child's moral lens is non-negotiable. He knows what's right and wrong. That childlike lens can be what these researchers are saying is a very effective place to start these conversations with parents. And particularly what I saw was that fathers and conservative parents show the biggest change with their daughters' attitudes shifting. So the role of the voices of young women here again and again comes back to young women changing the world through standing up and speaking out. Pretty amazing. And rock on to all the kids that are continuing to strike on Climate Fridays. I'm with you. I'm in solidarity with you. I love you.
You know, I think that's a great way to sort of close today's show, as we started with sort of talking intergenerationally about climate change. And now we've got some research showing this, and we can see the importance of this just in the faith community. And so with that, again, I want to thank our two guests today, Reverend Susan Hendershot and Reverend Brian Souter. It was an amazing conversation. I've learned so much. Warm Regards is a labor of love, and we're always looking for sponsors to help us grow, to sustain the amazing effort of the volunteers who run the show. If you've got something you'd like to share with our community, please reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Follow us on Twitter at Our Warm Regards. Send us an email with feedback at ourwarmregards@gmail.com. You can listen to all of our episodes on your sort of favorite podcast service, including iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Warm Regards is produced by Eric Mack and Justin Schell. Joe Stormer writes our transcripts, and Catherine Pinehart is our social media maven. My co-host today was Dr. Sarah Myrie. I'm Ramesh Longani. From all of us at Warm Regards, thanks for letting us into your head.